You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, November 20th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. On the program today, to talk to us about what is money? What really is the deficit? Should government tighten its belts like families? Stephanie Kelton, associate professor from the University of Missouri, Kansas City, research associate at the Levi Institute of New York City. Very interesting thinker, one of the leading thinkers in the modern monetary theory movement of economists. And I'm really looking forward to how this is going to drive one of our IMers absolutely crazy. Should we be back on the gold standard? Is this fiat money evil? Are we looking at hyperinflation? All of these questions and more will be interesting. It will be, I think, an incredibly interesting interview for a lot of you. With that said, I am sick. And I'm not going to sit here and blame my daughter. But last night, I think we both got food poisoning. And she was up starting at about 10 o'clock at night last night. She vomited 8 times over the course of the next 6 to 7 hours. And I woke up this morning feeling it myself. So we may have a short show today. However, we will get to the first salvo of the war on Christmas. Yes, I know it's that time of season again, ladies and gentlemen. And it's interesting, you know, I've always been meaning to go back and look at when the right starts up the war on Christmas, because there's been a couple of years where we haven't had the war on Christmas. And there's been a couple of years where we have. Now, many of you longtime listeners will be aware of what I consider to be my best appearance on television, or pretty darn close, was the war on Christmas debate I had on CNN with the guy for Concerned Women for America. The leader of the organization. We will play that eventually, probably as we always do traditionally, sometime over the next couple of weeks, probably leading up to Christmas. Also tomorrow, programming note, I think we will be doing an interview, but we will also be probably doing taking all of your calls and your IMs, if you want to email too, with questions on how you deal with your right-wing relatives at Thanksgiving dinner. As you know, I have a PhD in that from nowhere. But I spent a lot of time talking to Janine Garofalo's dad back in the day. And so if you want advice on how to deal with your family members at Thanksgiving, even if they're just not even conservative, just if you want to deal with your family members, make sure you call in or IM tomorrow and send us an email. hostess still being not quite fully liquidated yet. We'll talk about that later in the program if I don't pass out. Alan West has conceded. Yes, very gracefully for a insane person. And we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Stephanie Kelton.
Keep on rolling like a tone. Ooh.
Well, that was a nice musical interlude. Ladies and gentlemen, we are experiencing technical difficulties. Oh, my God. You telling me my... Ugh. Even my technical difficulties song is experiencing technical difficulties. Hopefully we'll have a that worked out in just moments. So let's start with this opening salvo in the War on Christmas, ladies and gentlemen. You see, you heathens, you secularists, let's face it, you Jews, you folks who think that somehow we should be separating religion from government, look at what you've done. Look at what you've done. This is from the 700 Club, Pat Robertson and his, I guess, his news guy. Here it is.
Thanksgiving isn't even here yet, and the battles over Christian Christmas displays already heating up. The city of Santa Monica, California is dropping their elaborate annual nativity scene after an atheist protest. The city allowed a nativity in their Palisades Park for nearly 60 years, including a series of 14 life-size Christmas displays. But then atheists set up non-religious displays, angering the community by comparing the Christmas displays to myths and fables. The churches that used to set up the nativity are now suing in federal court. They claim the city violated their freedom of speech by stopping the holiday tradition. Pat?
Well, it's, well, Christmas all over again. The Grinch is trying to steal our holiday. It's been so beautiful. The nation comes together.
Now, hold on for a second. So these atheist types are mocking Christmas by saying that it's a bunch of made-up characters. And meanwhile, Pat Robertson says, it's the Grinch who's stealing Christmas. Okay, I don't want to, look, I don't want to disrespect anybody's religion or belief system, but the Grinch is not real. It's a made-up character.
That's one that's 100% sure.
No, it's definitely made up. It was this Dr. Seuss. Dr. Seuss may have been a real doctor. I don't know, but he wrote about the Grinch. There's no blue furry animals. It doesn't exist. Now, you atheists who have been able to mind meld with Pat Robertson and caused him to believe in fabricated characters, you just disgust me. Take your mind melding somewhere else. Let's listen to what Pat Robertson has to say.
Christmas carols, we give gifts to each other. We have lighted trees, and it's just a beautiful thing. Atheists don't like our happiness. They don't want you to be happy. They want you to be miserable. They're miserable, so they want you to be miserable. So they want to steal your holiday away from you. Terry.
I like atheists are miserable. They're miserable. Terry. Well, there you go. I mean, you atheists, you miserable, miserable atheists who are making us all believe in your Grinch. Or, no, I'm confused.
I love, Sam has this just, you'll see it if you're watching it on Ustream or on YouTube later. You just have this, like, poignant Pat Robertson face while you're listening to him.
Well, it's no, very... I mean, I think we all sort of feel bad and lament that. All right, we've got to take a quick break. We got a new number. We'll try this one more time. All right, folks, we'll be right back with Stephanie Kelton.
Be strong.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome Stephanie Kelton. She is the associate professor at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and a research associate at the Levi Institute in New York City. Welcome to the program, Stephanie.
Thanks for having me. Thank you.
So I've got a lot of questions for you. And I had interviewed Bill Black the other day and wanted to ask him about modern monetary theory. And he said, well, Stephanie Kelton is the expert. And but let's start, if we could, with the gold standard and Bretton Woods. Can you tell my audience exactly what changed when we left the gold standard?
Sure. So you mentioned the Bretton Woods system. This was an international monetary system that was put in place at the end of World War II. It went into place in 1944, and it involved 44 countries around the world all agreeing to fix their currencies to the U.S. dollar and through the U.S. dollar into gold. And so the U.S. government pledged to all these other 43 countries that if you get dollars because you exchange your currency for the dollar at a fixed price, you can then convert the dollar at another fixed price, so many dollars per ounce of gold, and we give you the gold. And when you have a monetary system like that, obviously you have to be very careful about the way that you run your policy, because if you allow too many dollars to get out into circulation and people decide, well, I'd rather not hold the dollar, I want to just convert into gold, there's only so much gold available, right? It's finite. And so under this type of monetary system, it actually has very important implications for the kind of fiscal policy that you can run, how much you spend and how much you collect in taxes. And we went off of this system in 1971. President Nixon actually took the U.S. off of Bretton Woods in 1971. And so the dollar is no longer tied to gold, no longer convertible. It is a pure floating exchange rate, and it's a pure fiat, we say fiat currency.
And so what are the implications of that? I mean, it seems to me in some respects we're still sort of like grappling with the implications of that.
Well, I think that in a lot of ways it's fair to say that the U.S. government hasn't really realized that it's no longer on a gold standard. So we basically run our policy as if we're in a gold standard world, not recognizing that going off of gold and controlling your currency and letting it float means that you have this fiscal policy space that wasn't available to you anymore. It wasn't available to you previously, but all of a sudden all this space has opened up and we don't take advantage of the space. It's almost like, you know, you have a tile floor and you think that you're only allowed to stand on two or three tiles in the room. And in truth, you can walk around the room anywhere you want because you've got all this extra space opened up, but you confine yourself to this little area in the corner because you think you're still on a gold standard.
What is the policy that reflects us standing on just those two or three tiles?
Well, most importantly, the idea that you don't want to have a budget deficit that's too big because you're worried about spending, because you're worried that somehow if your deficits get too big and your debt gets too big, they're going to run into a situation where you can't pay it. And so we hear lots of things from policymakers, lawmakers talking about the debt not being sustainable, the U.S. going broke. President Obama said at one point, we're out of money. We're out of money, you know, as if the U.S. government can run out of the U.S. dollar. So we act like we've got to keep the supply of dollars and keep the level of spending constrained, sufficiently constrained, or terrible things are going to happen. We're going to become like Greece. We'll go broke like a household or a private business, not recognizing that the federal government is now the issuer of the currency and the rest of these folks are just simply users of the currency. Households are users, private businesses, state and local governments, and by the way, all of the countries that adopted the euro have placed themselves in the position of being the user of the currency, no longer the issuer. So if you look at Italy and you look at Italy's debt to GDP ratio today, it's roughly where it was in the mid-1990s. But in the mid-1990s, there was no debt crisis. You say, why was their debt just as big as it is today? And now they have a debt crisis, and back then they didn't. And the answer is fairly straightforward. It's because before, the debt was all denominated in lira. Mm. And the Italian government controlled the lira. And financial markets knew that the Italian government could always make payments in lira because they were the issuer of the currency. Now the debt's all euro-denominated. Financial markets recognize, hey, the euro doesn't come from the Italian government, so if we lend to them, that's got this risk now attached that it didn't used to have. And that's where the premium comes from, and that's why the bond vigilantes have so much power under this new monetary system.
But they don't. They don't have the same power. The bond vigilantes don't have the same power over us because we have the capacity to print more money.
And they recognize that. They absolutely recognize it. They recognize it in Japan. They recognize it in the UK. They recognize it in the U.S., where interest rates short term are zero and even longer term, right around 1%. And the reason that the bond vigilantes can't extract a premium, can't bully these governments, is because they know these governments can always pay. You can't say, I need a risk premium to compensate for the risk of default when the currency comes from all of these governments, you know?
So when it's at this juncture where someone will say, well, but that's a recipe for the Weimar Republic, where we'll be bringing a wheelbarrow full of cash to go buy a loaf of bread or something. Why is that not a danger to us? I mean, or is it?
What, the fact that we issue the currency or the fact that we could spend enough in order to get the economy to full employment?
Well, I guess the idea that if we issued the currency, if we started, if we borrowed money and use that money to get us to full employment, let's say, like fiscally, for instance, but we kept printing this money, I don't know if it's conventional wisdom, but there's certainly some belief in some sectors that say, well, that's what gives you hyperinflation.
Okay, well, hyperinflation is something that happens for very specific reasons. In the case of Weimar Germany, what you had was, in fact, still a gold standard in place. You had war reparations. The German government was trying to repay its war debt, and it needed gold in order to do that. And in order to get all the gold that it needed, had to issue lots of currency to buy the gold. And so you had lots of money creation. At the same time, you had the Belgians and the French come into Germany and take over a large industrial part of the economy, which kept supply down. So, you know, if you think Milton Friedman, you say inflation is caused by too much money chasing too few goods. Well, you had lots of currency creation, but you also had a crushing of the supply side of the economy because you simply didn't have the capacity to produce goods and services. Something similar happened in Zimbabwe. It's another more recent example of a hyperinflationary period, but there you had Mugabe come in, take away land from the white farmers and redistribute land to the blacks who didn't have the experience farming the land, didn't quite know exactly what to do with it when they got it, and all of a sudden you ran into the same kinds of problems on the supply side where you didn't have the capacity to produce, able to keep up with the demand for these food things and other goods and services. And so, you know, demand outstripped supply and prices went sky high. We don't have conditions like this in the U.S., and it's clear that we can achieve full employment without hyperinflating the economy. The last time we reached full employment in the U.S. was in the late 90s and early 2000s, right? We had actually one job vacancy for every job seeker. It's the only time in the last 35 years in the U.S. that we achieved in peacetime, I mean, in the last 35 years, that we had what anybody could reasonably refer to as full employment. We didn't have high inflation. In fact, we had very low inflation. The official unemployment rate was 3.7%. We had high productivity growth. The economy did very well. We didn't hyperinflate. So the idea that somehow if the government, through its ability to adjust taxes and government spending, plays a role in helping to move the economy to full employment, that's going to blow up the economy. That's going to be hyperinflation. But if the private sector can do it without the risk of hyperinflation, you know, cash registers don't discriminate. When you spend money in the economy, there isn't someone on the other end saying, will that be public or private today? I mean, a dollar spent is a dollar spent.
Right.
The federal government could safely lower taxes, increase government spending, allow aggregate demand to increase, because that's the problem that we have today. 23 million Americans who want full-time work and can't find it. The reason that the unemployment rate is 8.1% is that there isn't enough demand in the economy. Period. It's a simple problem, and there is a simple solution for that problem. Sales create jobs. Income creates sales. Raising taxes reduces income and therefore reduces sales. Cutting government spending reduces someone's income and therefore reduces sales. So all we're trying to do is suggest that because we have the monetary system that we have, we don't have to go out and get the currency from China in order to spend, that we can implement policy in a much more responsible way to achieve full employment. And by the way, it's when the economy is operating at full employment that deficits come down. And in the case of the Clinton years, they disappeared altogether. A strong economy naturally reduces the size of the deficit and brings down the debt.
So if we don't need to raise taxes, in other words, we can print more money. Why do we have taxes? Why do we need taxes? Why do we need to borrow money, issue bonds?
Well, we actually don't need to borrow money. We don't need to issue bonds. We do these things, but we do them voluntarily. I mean, it's our rule. So Congress could, in fact, under current law, spend additional money without offsetting through increased taxes or without borrowing. I'm not sure that I want to tell you what that is because it sounds a little crazy, but there is legislation on the books that would allow the Secretary of the U.S. Treasury to strike a coin mm-hmm. of any denomination of his choosing, deposit the coin into the Treasury's account at the Fed, and then spend from that account. Some folks in the blogosphere have written about this. There's a law professor at Yale. Okay, so it's not as if the idea hasn't been vetted. Law professor at Yale has looked at this, and in fact, there is a law on the books that would allow Tim Geithner, if he wanted to, today, to do this. And that would mean that there would be funds in the Treasury's account that could be spent that wouldn't add a dime to the national debt, that wouldn't require higher taxes, and that wouldn't require additional borrowing, and therefore you wouldn't have growing interest on the debt and all these other things. So the law is there. We could do it. I've never heard anybody, I was going to say serious, talk about it, except that, you know, you do have a law professor at Yale, so there have been serious folks who've talked about this. But anyway, we could do that.
So when we collect taxes, it is really is it just now sort of a tradition, or is it what gives value to our money? I mean, I think it's in David Graeber's book Debt. I think mm-hmm. where the idea of borrowing money, government borrows money, and then basically it gives value to the currency by saying that this is the way that we will pay off our debts, essentially.
Yeah, I mean, this is the way that governments historically have moved resources from the private domain into the public domain. The public sector wants things. It wants standing armies. It wants bridges and roads and other sorts of things. And historically, what governments did when they wanted these things was to impose taxes on a population of people, to make them in debt to the government, and then to tell them the way that you get yourself out of debt is to work and produce for me in order to earn my currency, which I pay you, and then you pay back a portion to me in the form of taxes, and that eliminates your debt. And so, yes, Graeber's book is a very good example of a study that looks carefully at how this has been done over the course of thousands of years by different governments.
So technically speaking, I mean, we don't need to collect taxes. I mean, is that right? I mean,
well, I don't think so. I think you have to be very careful because as you said a moment ago, taxes give value to the government's currency. And so if we just suspended every form of payment to government altogether, the monetary system would collapse. Why would anybody be willing to accept this otherwise worthless paper, intrinsically worthless, if it didn't have use in terms of settling obligations and, most importantly, debts to the state?
And just going back, because I want to also talk about our debt and deficit and this sort of notion of that government should tighten its belt when families tighten their belts, which has always driven me crazy. But I want to just make sure that in terms of inflation worries, we had 17% or some odd inflation back in the 70s. What was that a function of? And why should we not be concerned to have that again? Is it simply because we have enough capacity, unused capacity in our economy right now, or what is it?
No, because the experience of the 70s really showed that you can have quite high inflation in spite of the fact that you're not using your capacity. So the period of the 1970s is often referred to as a period of stagflation, right, where we had simultaneously high inflation and high unemployment. So the inflation that we experienced in the 70s was not the result of government trying to operate its fiscal policy to achieve full employment. The inflation that we achieved in the we experienced in the 70s was more akin to something along the lines of what happened in Zimbabwe or Weimar, in the sense that it was supply side pressures that drove those inflation, that drove that inflation. So the oil price shocks, right? Oil spiked in the 1970s on a couple of different occasions, 71 and 73, I think, and then there are pass through effects because it takes so much energy to move goods and services and produce other things that it fed through into the generalized price index, into the CPI. So you can definitely have inflation. You could have inflation because of commodity prices rising, right, feeding into the prices of other goods and services, quite independent of the fact that you're not at full employment.
I don't discount
the concern about inflation, but if we're talking about demand pull inflation, too much money chasing too few goods and services, then I think that there's not a good reason right now to be concerned that if we were to spend more, that we would generate inflationary pressure. Because as I said, you have lots of capacity. You have capacity in terms of the factories operating well below historically high utilization rates, and you have lots of labor that wants to contribute but is unable to find work.
So
you can definitely get inflation on the supply side.
Right, but we don't have enough demand right now to create that dynamic that would drive it.
To create the demand pull dynamic.
Okay.
You could have a speculative bubble that feeds into commodity price increases that then feeds into prices in general, but that wouldn't have anything to do with trying to run your economy at full employment.
So let's move to the deficit, because of course, you know, everything that we hear now, it's dominating our politics, is this notion of the fiscal cliff, which is really sort of it's sort of stunning in a way, because we're being told that we've got to be afraid of falling off this fiscal cliff. And so the solution that we keep hearing, or at least all the solutions that we seem to keep hearing, whether it's Simpson-Bowles letter, as I call it, or other plans to impose austerity, all seem to, the solution for this fiscal cliff all seem to be let's fall off of something tall. The solutions to the fiscal cliff don't seem to be solutions, but they in themselves seem to be the fiscal cliff. In other words, this desire to close the deficit. What is it important for us to know about deficits?
Well, I think it's important for us to know that when the government spends more than it collects, let's say government spends 100 and taxes back 90, we kind of have to remember that the extra 10 went somewhere. If they spend 100 and only take back 90, someone got the extra 10. And the someone who gets the extra 10 is the non-government sector. And so we tend to forget, we focus on the government's deficit, and we're so accustomed to thinking in terms of our own personal finances that it feels wrong if somebody's spending more than their income. You know, that can't be sustainable. That can't be good. Well, it's different when the currency comes from you on the one hand, and you also have to stop and think, well, their deficit becomes our surplus. And so if people are saying we need to cut Fort, say, Bull Simpson, we need to reduce deficits by $4 trillion over the next 10 years, it is an equivalent statement to say Bull Simpson advocates cutting the non-government surplus by $4 trillion over the next 10 years. Those are equivalent statements. But if you asked people, are you in favor of the government cutting your surplus? Everybody would say, no, I'm pretty sure. Only they all support the government reducing its deficit, not recognizing that they're opposite sides of the same coin.
And so, in other words, there is no this notion that somehow if the if the government borrows too much money or something, it's taking it out of the economy. It's not taking it out of the economy. It's actually putting more money back into the economy.
Well, it's putting financial assets back in. When you say if the government borrows, so let's go back to the example. If the government spends 100, taxes 90, and then sells government bonds in the amount of 10, let's put it in terms of billion, well, then instead of 10 billion in non-interest earning government dollars, you end up with $10 billion in U.S. treasuries, interest bearing. So you're adding financial assets to the non-government sector to the penny when the government deficit spends, whether it borrows or not.
And so I've seen you say that there's three aspects, I guess, to contextualize the deficit, the government, the domestic government sector, and the domestic private sector, and there, but for the rest of the world, there's a one-to-one inverse relationship there. Is that right?
Yeah, so you can divide these things into three parts, which is what you just did, or you can simplify and just say government and non-government, where the non-government includes the domestic, private, and the rest of the world. So if the government is running a deficit that's 6% of GDP, the non-government must by definition have a surplus equal to 6% of GDP. Now, some of that surplus is accumulating in the rest of the world because the U.S. runs trade deficits. And so a portion of that surplus accumulates somewhere else, but a very large portion of it, even a bigger portion, accumulates here at home domestically. And so it becomes the surplus in the household sector. It adds to the savings of the corporate sector. So businesses and households benefit financially from the government deficit spending.
And is there ever a problem where government deficit, or ever a time where government deficits are a problem?
Sure. The deficit, just like the deficit can be too small, the government's deficit can be too big. And the two real risks that one would want to pay attention to, and you're talking about whether the deficit is too big, are inflation and the exchange rate. So if the government runs a deficit that begins to get too large, it's true that you could get inflationary pressure, and it's true that the currency could come down in value. In other words, that the dollar could depreciate on world markets. What would be the effects of those things? We kind of talked about the inflationary effect already, and we can agree that inflation erodes the real purchasing power of the currency, and that that is something that governments should avoid. With respect to the currency, if the deficit gets too big and the dollar loses value on global markets, then it means that we're going to pay more for the goods and services that we purchase from abroad, but it means the rest of the world is going to pay less for the things that they buy from us. And so, in some sense, a weakening dollar improves the current account. In other words, the trade balance would tend to improve if the dollar were to weaken, which would then add to GDP, which would then bring down the deficit. So there may be some stabilization that occurs there even as the currency gets weaker.
And so what are the steps that we can take when we perceive that the deficit, or what are the signs that the deficit is too large in those instances?
Well, if you begin to get inflationary pressure and you can identify and trace that inflationary pressure to demand, then the way to reduce the inflationary pressure is to reduce demand, is to reduce spending. And the way that you reduce spending is either by spending less yourself. If you're the government, you spend less. if you want to have everybody else spend less, then you raise taxes so that they have less income available to spend. So government should really be watching two things. It should be watching unemployment, and it should be watching inflation. And if inflation is not a problem and unemployment is a problem, then it's an indication that the government's deficit is too small. If inflation begins to become, you begin to see signs that inflation is becoming a problem, it's an indication that the government's deficit may be too large.
And so, faced with the fiscal cliff, what do you think that really we should be doing at this point, in terms of the Bush tax cuts expiring, the sequestering of the automatic cuts to the budget, unemployment benefits ending, et cetera, et cetera? What is it that we should be doing at this point?
Well, the fiscal cliff is just haphazard and reckless policy. It's just, let's just make up a whole bunch of things that are going to happen, and if we don't do anything, these things automatically take place. You want lawmakers to actually be considered and reasoned when they put budget policy into place. And so you want to see a set of national priorities. You want lawmakers to listen to their constituents. You want them to pay attention to what's happening in the real economy. If it is clear that the economy isn't achieving the macro goals of full employment and low inflation, then you want them finding out what it is that they need to spend more money on or whose taxes they ought to be cutting. And so the ideal situation would be for folks to recognize that they ought to make decisions that aren't haphazard in nature and make good macroeconomic policy. That's obviously not what's happening with the fiscal cliff, and it's really not what's happening with any attempt to strike some sort of a grand bargain to avoid the fiscal cliff, because, you know, those are sort of different versions of the same thing. It's austerity either way. The difference is in the timing and the particulars of the deal, but the implications are either way, taxes go up on someone and spending goes down on something.
And finally, give me a sense. I mean, it's fascinating to me that there's still a sense that in some ways we as a society are still trying to figure out the implications of coming off the gold standard. I mean, do you have a sense of, and your perspective on this is, I don't know enough about the different schools of thought in economics, but it's certainly not one that is presented in on our cable news shows. Do you think? I mean, just give me a sense of how the institution of economics, or there, the educational and the institutes and whatnot are they coming to this understanding of our monetary system? Are they of our economy, or is it is there growth in this in terms of people beginning to perceive the way that our economy works in this way?
I really think that there are. It's happening too slowly for my personal taste, but when you start studying economics, one of the first things you're confronted with when you take a course in economics is a budget constraint. And you talk about how households have to allocate their scarce resources among all these competing wants. Then when you move up to the aggregate level, it becomes the same story. You've got federal government facing a budget constraint without the recognition that there's a difference between being someone who has to earn the currency or borrow the currency and being the person from whom the currency comes, being the issuer of the currency. So when you push folks on this issue, and we've been pushing now for almost two decades for people to begin to recognize that there's a fundamental difference between what the user of the currency can do and what the issuer of the currency can do. We got a lot of pushback early on. You know, these ideas are very difficult to free yourself from. But people like Joe Stiglitz, Nobel Prize winning economist, Paul Krugman, another Nobel Prize winning economist, Dean Baker, a very popular economist who writes an awful lot on the, you know, more progressive side and so forth. We've talked to these people for a very long time, and at first the reaction was sort of, no, surely, you know, government can't spend in an unconstrained way. Well, we said, well, no, it's not unconstrained. The constraint is inflation. The constraint is the exchange rate. And I'm telling you, if you read what these people are writing now, it looks very different from what they were writing even 3 years ago. You're beginning to see recognition in, say, Paul Krugman's columns, in interviews with Stiglitz, in Dean Baker's work, and others as well. But these are the ones with the big megaphones. And they're starting to put these caveats into their pieces where they say, well, of course, this is different if you're the person who issues the currency. This is why Greece is different from the U.S. This is why the U.S. can never become Greece. So we're getting there, and I hope that we'll continue to move in that direction because, you know, the implications are so important for the lives of so many million Americans. Policymakers to sit on their hands and cry poor when you've got millions of people who want to contribute and want to be part of this you know, great economy that we have or that we could have. It's just not only frustrating, it's just really just quite sad.
And do you think that they are trapped in a worldview that is still a function of Bretton Woods, or is it that there's just more of a political agenda, or is it mixed? I mean, you know, is Pete Peterson just sort of living out the era before we went off the gold standard, or is it that just that he just sort of feels like it's not really appropriate for people to have any type of lack of financial pressure when they're senior citizens?
Well, I think it's pretty clear what Pete Peterson wants. Pete Peterson wants, among other things, he wants entitlements very much on the table, but in particular, he wants Social Security delivered to Wall Street. I mean, that's really ultimately what this is about. They want privatization, or at the minimum, for starts, partial privatization of Social Security. So I think it's very much politically motivated.
All right. Well, Stephanie Kelton, thank you so much for joining us. Associate Professor, University of Missouri, Kansas City, Research Associate at the Levi Institute in New York. Thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks so much.
Bye-bye. All right, folks. We will go into the better half of the program. I will endeavor to persevere. I don't know how much more I got in me. I'm not feeling very well. I think I already mentioned that earlier on in the program today. You can call us at 646-257-3920. You can IM me at Majority FM. Folks, it is your membership that allows me to go out and buy medication for my stomach and to wash all of the blankets and sheets that my daughter vomited on last night. And, of course, it also keeps this show alive. So if you can support the program, much appreciated. See you in the better half.